Geostrategy, in my mind, is almost an inflection point. It's how companies think strategically, act proactively, and neutralize surprises. Stability, predictability is so important to business operations. Nobody makes a CapEx decision in the morning and has it done by noon.
Right.
Same. You don't unwind that immediately. That's why geopolitics has such an outsized influence. Look at all of the world events that have happened so far this year. Huge impact on business. Geostrategy is a way to think about this that harnesses all of that, right? It harnesses the fact that this morning's opportunity becomes an almost insurmountable challenge before you have finished your coffee. So how do we harness the sensory overload of information that is always changing, sometimes conflicts, and isn't always reliable, and build that stability, bake in resilience? How do we ensure durability? I hear companies talk a lot about being nimble, responding. Geostrategy reframes that because it's about leaning into headwinds and emerging stronger. You define the four corners of the box.
Welcome back to Rittner Reflections, episode 31. I'm Jeff Rittner, and this is part two of my conversation with Jeanette Chu. In part one, Jeanette helped us understand the strategic environment companies are operating in, a world where national security and competitiveness are now intertwined. But strategy is only half the story. The real test is what happens inside companies. The controls they build, the decisions they make, the risks they manage, and the systems they put in place to keep pace with this rapidly changing environment. So in part two, we're going to talk about geostrategy and how it acts every day in compliance programs, engineering decisions, supply chain choices, and day-to-day execution. So Jeanette, welcome back. So good to have you with me.
And good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, and I appreciated our first part, just a great conversation. And so as we go forward here, I thought we could start where we left off. And as we're talking about companies, you know, what should companies prepare for over the next 12 to 24 months?
You know, if I had a good answer for that, I wouldn't be on your podcast.
Right.
I would have retired to an uninhabited island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean somewhere, right?
Like Guam?
Well, Guam's inhabited,
yeah,
right?
Yes. So okay.
It would be somewhere a little bit more remote. I think it's a really important question that you posed. Maybe it's less about preparing for the next 12 to 24 months and more about operational readiness to build resilience so that you're prepared for anything. With that in mind, I think a lot about choke points. And we talk about choke point technologies. We see this a lot, both in this administration and previous administration, and before that, the first Trump administration, a focus on here's a node, here's a choke point. We don't want China to be able to go beyond that, or we can control this. We have to think about our own choke points. And to my surprise, I have found that in a lot of situations, choke points are not at the tip of the spear. They're not at that bleeding edge. It's almost a little bit of a for want of the nail. A choke point, and Jeff, I really want to hear what you think of this, is suddenly, as much as people talk about AI and GPUs and compute power and all of that, what is everyone worried about today?
It's a fascinating topic. And in my career at Intel, we spent a lot of time thinking about choke points because we were in the middle of, you know, developing the most sophisticated chips of the time, right? And I spent a lot of time with my team trying to help us figure out what's the full supply chain of an integrated circuit. So you start with an idea, and there's a whole design team, and these things are complex. So there's a whole design team, and then how do you then get to a point where you produce it and then you eventually sell it. And that was a really instructive time because we had to think about not only our role, but the role of all the suppliers around us. And how could we get the equipment we needed? How could we get the materials that we needed? And I think today this has become really a challenge, as you mentioned, the choke point idea. It's not necessarily the tip of the spear. I mean, critical minerals. Those are now all of a sudden, I think, a choke point, because if you can't get the minerals you need for the materials to develop a semiconductor, you can't produce them. And so now all of a sudden, how does a company deal with that? How do they make sure they have that supply chain to be able to produce?
You are so right. And even beyond critical minerals, which are, and rare earth elements, yes, right? There's even very common things. I had heard that because of the situation in the Middle East and with the Strait of Hormuz, that helium, which a common element,
yes,
not a rare earth,
yes,
so many industrial applications, was not moving. So when I think about choke points, I think about things like that. Common, ordinary, everyday, but for want of a nail. Yeah.
But you know, it's a really, really excellent point, Jeanette, because we're talking geostrategy, and strategy is about taking in all of the factors that would contribute to your success. And if you can't get helium, what does that do then? And to what extent do you have to go to get the helium? I'll give you a story. During the pandemic, if you understand semiconductor manufacturing, these fabs, today they're $20 billion to build and operate. And if you shut it down for a day, it's millions of dollars. And the reason is because shutting it down is a whole process and restarting it is a whole nother process. So I can tell you back in, I forget what year it was, when we were having supply chain issues, and you remember all the ships outside of the port in Long Beach?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and there were containers sitting on these ships and they couldn't get it through customs. And we had a potential machine down situation in one of our fabs in Oregon. And what we needed was sitting in a container on one of those ships. And I remember, you know, we were at probably, I would call it N minus 2 months. And then it became N minus a month. And people really started getting, you know, nervous. And what, you know, and we were the center of all attention because we're customs. We need to make sure we get this thing unloaded and through customs. It got down to weeks, and we were able, fortunately, because of our customs status, we participate in CTPAT and other programs, we were able to actually get the goods cleared while they were still sitting on the container. And then eventually that boat got in and we got it off, and we had to truck that thing to Oregon. And I think we made it by days. But there's a great example of, you're talking about a choke point. I mean, that almost stopped the factory from moving forward, which would be millions of dollars. So there's an example, wow, of how that works.
Jeff, what an amazing story. And it really speaks to the strength and talent of your team that they were able to get this cleared while it was still sitting in a container. That's so fantastic.
Yeah, it was one of those moments where you're, like I said, you're the center of attention, whether you like it or not.
Because that's what they say, not all heroes wear capes.
Right.
There you go.
Yeah, but that's a story, you know, one situation, but that story in today's world is replicated every day by companies around the world. And as you brought up, rightfully so, the Strait of Hormuz, right? And there are companies today, I'm sure, that are going through all sorts of efforts and things to try to figure out how are they going to, you know, obtain what's critical to continue to produce or whatever they're doing, right? I mean, I think that's real. It's what goes on. And that's why geostrategy is so important, to be prepared.
Yeah, geostrategy, in my mind, is a four-dimensional critical path analysis, to put it into engineering terms. And I think with respect to business operations, for all of that to work, you can't have points of failure in that.
Right.
You need every piece of operations. I don't think you would have gotten that critical item to your fab in time, mm-hmm, had there not been the executive attention, as uncomfortable, yeah, as it might have felt in that moment,
yes,
or everyone else doing their jobs and synchronizing, yeah, perfectly.
Yeah. And I think the other lesson from that story was all the work that had been done years prior to have the CTPAT, to have the relationship with Customs, trusted relationship that they would make such a move on our behalf. I remember during the pandemic, we had pressure from countries around the world to shut everything down. And there were exceptions made for, you know, activities that were critical to, you know, to society functioning at that moment, right? And one of those was electronics. I mean, everybody now was at home working on their laptops. And if you couldn't get a laptop or you couldn't get electronics, how was things going to continue? And so our fabs, our factories, whether they were the fabs or the assembly test, we had to go government by government and make the case that these were critical to keep functioning. This is another example of where having good relationships with government officials goes a long way when you reach these points to be able to get things done.
Absolutely.
So.
And those chips are also in things like ECMO machines mm-hmm. that were in such short supply and right. ventilators and used throughout right. hospitals and even yeah. in today's yeah. environment with yeah. various disease outbreaks.
Right, right.
People rely on them.
Yes.
To sustain life.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I think this is where I think it really ties back to this idea of companies. You were talking about how does this actually work? In reality, and I think this is where I would say, no matter what industry you're in, I would say that companies need to invest in their trade departments. It's not the time to skimp.
Not at all.
Right? I mean, this is the time to really invest, because whether it's, you know, a supply chain stoppage or shortage, or whether it's the rising cost of doing business because of tariffs, what are you going to do about it? So I don't know, do you have any suggestions of what companies could be doing to better prepare for these geopolitical and, you know, challenges that we're facing?
Think very broadly and strategically about identifying the potential choke points that we talked
right.
about.
Right.
And game out what you can do. Not just, well, if that happens, we'll do this. But keep going.
Right.
Keep going.
Right.
There's a point in the Foreign Service exam where you're given a scenario. And you give an answer. Oh, what if there's a plane crash? Okay, there's a plane crash. So there are 20 Americans on this plane. And then they just keep pushing and pushing and pushing to test your critical thinking skills, your strategic mm-hmm. thinking skills, mm-hmm. your problem-solving skills, until you finally say, I have no clue. And you can make stuff up. You can say, well, I would call this person. And, well, I was at dinner with my friend in the Canadian embassy when this happened. And you know,
yeah.
you can push back by framing. That's what I would encourage companies to do, is to not just be like, oh, well, so we have this backup plan and that backup plan, but really pressure test it all the way through.
Yeah, what you're describing, I would call scenario planning, this idea of scenario planning, game boarding. You've probably heard that as well. It's what you're describing, right? Where you actually play out what could happen and what would you do? What were your options and so on? And I think those are things, I don't know, today, I think it might be difficult for companies to perform these activities because things are happening so fast. It's almost like you're in crisis mode, and you want to be doing these things before crisis mode. So I think that's the challenge.
Well, to your point, the preparation of having a trade compliance team mm-hmm. that's already been stood up, yeah. even in our world, export controls or customs expertise overnight, it comes through years of seeing fact patterns and knowing regulations and understanding operations and having those relationships even within your own company. Building that expertise, and you asked for business advice, I'm going to give a piece of career advice, actually.
Okay.
What I tell people nowadays is, look, trade compliance is something that is here to stay. It's a real thing, and it's got a real seat at the table. So become a licensed customs broker. There's 14,000 of them in the United States. Think about what is going on around us. It is a credential that you will always have. It is a knowledge toolkit that you will always have, that you can, in a crisis moment, answer that question. Become a trade lawyer.
That's a very good suggestion to get the customs broker license. What about on the export side? What would you say for people to really become, you know, solid in that space? What are some of the things they could do?
Wow. There are so many different entry points nowadays yeah. into export controls. My advice is to start at the most basic levels. Understand the paperwork. Understand right. what is SNAP-R or what's the DDTC portal nowadays? Is it functioning? All of that. Know what all the forms are, what mm-hmm. they do. Understand that paperwork really, really, really matters. Mm-hmm. And getting it right matters. Mm-hmm. it's in those fine line details. There are a lot of people that look at this, they study this, maybe they're studying trade or trade policy at the academic level in university and right. even graduate school, whatever. There's a reason why newly minted baby lawyers sometimes start off doing things like filing license, get that experience, go into the FAPS. Some of my best interviews and audits and all of that are with warehouse workers or people working the line in a machine shop. Talk to R&D. Engineering degree, incredibly valuable. I know someone who has a PhD in biochemistry, worked in drug discovery for well over a decade. Brilliant scientist. She is now in trade compliance and doing a terrific job, now having her own consulting practice after building a team at a major pharmaceutical company.
True, getting the basics down is a great starting point. I always found in my career that the people who worked in the operations were the ones that advanced the quickest because they understood how everything works, as opposed to just coming in at the top level and not having a clue how it really works, right?
Right.
So I think that that's definitely good advice. So Jeanette, have you worked with any companies that are treating compliance as a strategic capability?
Absolutely.
And can you give some examples of what it looks like? I mean, what do you see when you see a company that's doing that?
I see having a in-house trade counsel backed up by a team, a very, very deep bench mm-hmm. that they can call upon when they need it, outside advisors, whether that's law firms or consultants. I see when that person may also play a role as an officer of the company. I see when trade compliance is taken seriously and given resources when it's needed, when they invest in the people. You say, how do you get to be something like a LCB on the export side? It used to be through training opportunities and outreach like BIS annual update, which sadly has gone by the wayside, at least for this year, taking
yes.
pause. And it's that continuous learning and growth process. I think that's what makes some of your former guests, like Karen Murphy, Bruce Jackson, mm-hmm. some of these other folks, just so brilliant at what they do, is that they never stop learning and they never stop thinking. They're not afraid, you know, mm-hmm. people that jump in and embrace new technologies, new ways of thinking. A lot of buzz is going on in our field, Jeff, right now, you know, about
yes.
like, should we be using AI? How can we use AI responsibly and be able to rely on it? Whether that's for commodity classification or commodity jurisdiction determination, maybe licensing or monitoring compliance with license conditions. So it's about not just grabbing the newest tool, but using it in smart ways that are fit for purpose.
There's no shortage of work going on to try to use the technology and the AI to solve, and it's a challenge. I've seen people trying to grapple with it, and it's the reliability is a really critical point, right? And as compliance professionals, you want to be absolutely locked down. You don't want it. You don't want to live in that sort of what if world. And so I think that makes it hard to be reliant on tools. At the same time, you can make mistakes if you do things manually as well. I have my great story. I don't know if I've told this story on the podcast before, but I'll tell you a great story of that. I got a call one day from the Bureau of Census, and they were 48 hours away from having to publish the trade statistics for that month. And they had uncovered a huge uptick, spike in the numbers from Intel. So we scrambled around, tried to go back to the data, and long story short, we eventually uncovered that someone manually was putting in the information into the AAS tool, and instead of putting in the unit price, they put the part number.
Oh my God. Which is probably 12 digits long.
Yes. So we had to, you know, fortunately we found that and they were able to kind of adjust their numbers, but it could have had implications on what was published to the world on trade statistics. It's because of a manual error. So we always get concerned about the potential errors of our tools and AI and so on, but you can have manual errors. So sometimes having systems and tools is a good way to go. And so it's just trying to make sure you do the work to ensure that it is something you can trust and it's accurate before you implement. As you've worked with companies, I'm really curious, where have you seen companies trip up when it comes to enforcement. I think in our earlier part one, we talked a bit about enforcement and so on, but just getting down to the nuts and bolts, what are some of the areas where I think people trip up over when it comes to some of the enforcement issues?
If you get commodity jurisdiction, which tells you whether your product is under State Department or Commerce jurisdiction wrong, you will not get anything else right. It begins with that.
Okay.
So from there, you go to commodity classification. And if your product is not classified properly, again, everything will emanate and flow from that. These are very critical foundational steps. I used to tell clients when I was in consulting, look, this is the foot bones connected to the ankle bones connected to the shin bone. And so it goes.
So you're saying that companies should get commodity classifications first.
And jurisdictions first,
and
right?
Jurisdictions.
Because it starts with doing CJ. Even if you know that you're on the commerce side, you have to at least be certain to ask that question correctly.
One of the things I've heard recently is there's not a lot coming out of BIS. And so what's your advice today for companies with BIS? Do you show up at the Commerce Department? Do you keep calling? Any thoughts? Because I know folks I've heard that it's been difficult to get, you know, responses or approvals.
I think that's more on the licensing side.
Okay.
Of course, licensing officers are also the same people that are dealing with commodity classification requests or CCAT.
Right. Yes.
So again, it's all tied together.
Right.
BIS has certainly lost a lot of deep expertise, long-time employees. They are backfilling. Congress is paying very close attention. Just 2 months ago, the House Foreign Affairs Committee reported out 23 bills and amendments, all relating to export controls. And a significant number of them were focused on addressing some of these challenges at BIS. More export enforcement officers, which we've been watching over the past few years, more export control officers overseas at more posts, authorization for more technical experts to support some of the work that the Office of Export Administration does, modernization at BIS. These are all things that are moving through Congress, or at least has gotten the attention of Congress. And I think that's very important. I don't recommend, Jeff, showing up randomly at the Commerce Department door. I don't think that is going to be and particularly well for you. But the Undersecretary Kessler has told the business community that he has an open door and is receptive. And with Congress's focus on this area, certainly I'd be going to my representative to say, hey, listen, I'm an employer and a taxpayer and a stakeholder in these very important national security policy areas. Here's my situation.
That's a good step. Good advice. Yeah. You know, one of the things that we focused on back in the day with BIS was not necessarily to go and meet with them to ask for anything, but to help them better understand the business, the choke points, the technology itself. And we used to, I don't know if you ever attended one of ours, we used to have what was called a technology day. And we would invite representatives from BIS, Commerce, from State, and so on. And then we would have our engineers come in and just say, here's the reality of 5G, what it does do, what it doesn't do, and so on. Just so there was understanding. I don't know if there's any receptivity to those sort of things anymore, but that usually worked out quite well. It allowed the government officials to better understand the reality of what's going on inside the four walls of Intel, for example.
So I've never had the privilege of going to an industry day, but I have been inside Intel.
Yes.
I've been to your Intel museum.
Mm.
The moment I got the phone call from BIS that I had been selected for the ECO role in Beijing, I was actually in the Bay Area with my family on, I think, home leave. Hung up the phone and said, we're going down to Silicon Valley. Intel has a museum. And I just remember standing there on the floor and looking at this massive mock-up of a chip and how information flows. It was so illustrative. Mm. And since then, again, I have no idea how many factory visits across how many different industries I've done, some of the most profoundly educational experiences of my life. And for BIS, they've had these technical advisory committees, Jeff. I believe you've been a longstanding member for regulations and procedures. When I was at BIS, it was fascinating to have industry representatives come in and explain to us, this is how this breaks down. This is what this means. This is that component that makes your phone do this one action.
No, we found those were extremely helpful. The engineering folks at BIS loved it. So that's something that maybe recommending to those listening, that if there's opportunities to utilize the talent you have in your organizations to educate government officials, whether it's BIS or any others, CBP or whatever, that's certainly time well worth it.
So, I can tell you that National Foreign Trade Council members regularly host government officials.
Okay.
The feedback from all quarters, whether I'm talking with someone on the Hill in government or in the company, has been uniformly positive. Really kudos, because it's a lot of work to pull those off.
Absolutely. I'd like to just kind of bring this up a little bit, and let's talk to CEOs, CFOs, C-suite. Okay, we've been talking about geo strategy and how important it is to kind of get ahead of things and so on. What would be your advice to that sort of C-suite level? What should they focus on?
CEOs should think about geo strategy as a force multiplier, because that's what it is. How does this amplify the reach of my product? How does this push out my brand? How does this return and increase not only share value, but future value of my company in R&D, in that next gen product, in all of the frontier things that we've already talked about? Right. Geostrategy is critical to that effort.
That's great. That's great advice. I would just kind of add on to that, Jeanette, that I found when a trade organization, trade compliance organization in a company is heads down on compliance, there's sometimes a perception that the compliance is hindering us from our strategy. And when a trade organization starts to themselves look at the world from a strategic perspective, and how can I take my role in compliance and turn that into a strategy, into an opportunity? So for example, just the idea that you would go in and get an export license, right? Maybe one of your latest products that's coming down the road, so that when that product was ready to ship, you already had the authorization. To me, that's a strategy, and that's a forward-looking growth role, as opposed to, we can't do this because the rules say you can't do it unless you have an export license. I don't know if how that lands with you, but that's...
Oh, no. I think that is, you're hitting the nail on the head. That's the future, the present reality and future of trade compliance. We're not the ones that are there to say no. We are there side by side as enablers of the business to facilitate business operations, because nothing will slow you down, spend your money faster than an enforcement action or a consent decree, agreement, or God forbid, a monitorship, right?
Right.
So having trade compliance, be forward leaning, be forward thinking. And not just your export license, but what about licenses from other companies? That critical mineral license to get that critical ingredient, if you will, that you need for your product is incredibly important.
Yeah, and I don't know if you'd agree with me, but I found that one of the most effective use of my time was to meet with the business so I could understand their objectives, their technologies, you know, the roadmap, if you will. So that way I could begin to strategically think about what can I do to make sure we're able to perform the goals that the company has. I'll tell a story, because this intersects with you when you were in China. But way back 20 years or so ago, as a company, we realized we wanted to have wafer manufacturing in China.
In Dalian, I remember.
In Dalian, yes, you remember. That's where you first got connected. Well, before that, we met with BIS, and I'll just to make the story quicker, we met with them for a period of 6 months. We even brought out some of the BIS officials that you've worked with. I won't name them all, but we brought them out to our New Mexico facility so they could see how it actually works. What were our security protocols? How do we manage things? So we had numerous conversations, and we talked about what a license would look like. What were the parameters, right? How far we could go here, what we couldn't do, et cetera. We talked about all of that. And it was my job at that time. I remember it was the beginning of August, It was my job to submit the license. And it was quite a work to put that together. I submitted that license and we were all blown away. We received approval in 30 days.
Wow.
For a wafer fabrication in China. And the reason I share that story is because I think it makes the point that it is the forward-looking, getting in front of it, meeting with BIS for 6 months so that they fully understood what we were going to do and what we weren't going to do. I think when it came time to approve the license, it was done. It was fait accompli because we had already had those conversations. So I guess I just share that story as for our listeners to think about how can you take the time to really strategically think about what it would take to move your business forward and go through those steps well in advance before you ever need it. As we wrap up, Jeanette, we're getting to the end of time here. I wanted to just really get your thought about this geo strategy as maybe a function. And I don't know if you envision or foresee, is this something that a company should establish, like a person or a group that's their job is geo strategy
or not? What do you think?
A little bit like trade compliance. I found trade compliance in every part of a company. I remember one place embedded it in real estate and mind blown. Typically it's under legal, just to reassure you. I don't know if every company needs a dedicated geo strategy function. I think it's more important that thinking happens at the board and at the C-suite level. We haven't talked about the board, but the board is acutely sensitive to these shifts and is often doing a lot of horizon scanning in order to set the trajectory of the company. The C-suite manages tone and execution. And that tone of geostrategic thinking flows throughout the company. It becomes part of the company's DNA, the same way that compliance thinking has, in many cases, become part of the DNA of a company, where it's not, this is an impediment, this is a stop that I have to go to, but this more, this is just part of our process. Our process is this. And that's what I envision the future of geostrategy in companies to be. The best companies are already there.
Very good advice. Well said. Well, anything else, Jeanette, while you have the mic?
I am so profoundly grateful to have been able to have a front row seat through all of these many inflection points, Jeff, that you and I have shared through the years. And I'm excited for what comes. I'm so grateful to everyone that helped train me in this community when I knew absolutely nothing, folks like Karen Murphy, for example, and many, many, many others. My time at BIS was transformational, to say the least. And the privilege, the amazing privilege of working with the most dynamic, forward-thinking, fast-moving companies in the world here at the National Foreign Trade Council is just an unprecedented opportunity. I am humbled every single day by that trust. Mm. And that's really what it is.
Well, I have to say, Jeanette, I've known you for many years, and every time we've ever intersected, the conversation has been rich. You've taught me so many things about what really to think about and look at, and I really appreciate you. It's been wonderful.
It's been my pleasure as well. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Well, finishing up here, across these two conversations, one thing really becomes clear, that strategy and execution can't be separated anymore. The world is moving way too fast. The companies need to understand the geopolitical environment, and they need the systems and the governance and the discipline to act on it. So, Jeanette, thank you for helping us connect the dots from the big picture forces shaping this moment to the operational reality companies face every day. And to everyone listening, I hope this series gives you a clearer framework to navigate a world where geopolitics is now part of the job. Until next time, thank you very much.